Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about two movies, Cry Macho and The Eyes of Tammy Faye. And the one thing we thought was the thread going through both movies is that they both have characters in them that want to be liked, you know, so whether you like them or not. It is certainly the intent that these are both meant to be crowd pleasers as movies and to appeal to as many people as possible. And the first one, Cry Macho, is the latest movie by Clint Eastwood, who has directed and starred himself in several movies, you know, in the last, well, in his whole career. But in the last 10 years or so, Mike, wouldn't you say that he's done some really great stuff? And each time something comes out, you think, wow, is this going to be the last one? Is this where he's going to have to end his career? And you can't help but look at the movie from that standpoint when you go to see it, that, you know, especially if you're a Clint Eastwood fan, this may be, you know, the last one. So in terms of that, where should we start in terms of Cry Macho, in terms of placing this in Clint Eastwood's career, where he's now 91, and this is his latest offering?
Well, it's really quite striking, and I want to reinforce this point, how few filmmakers into their 90s are still directing and acting and doing all that. And in many ways, it's an unfair burden in terms of looking on it with that kind of melancholic regard. Is this the last one? Because we've been saying that for a while now with Clint Eastwood, and he keeps making more movies. So at some point, I was able to put it out of my mind. But you know what? The film itself, ironically, wants you to think about such matters because it really is about an old codger. And I guess Clint Eastwood's been a codger since he was a young guy, but now he's a genuine old codger. And how someone like that still is terse and tough and this and that, but essentially good at heart and so on. And so in this film, there's a lot of dialogue and a lot of situations that actually reinforce that sense of aging and what it means for this character. By the same token, and on a less felicitous note, there are places where, because it's Clint Eastwood, he's still the toughest guy in town, right? But it's a little more difficult to pull that off when you're into your 90s sometimes. And there are a few scenes that I would call borderline implausible. By that, I mean, as I'm watching, I'm thinking, yeah, I don't know how many people could get away with this. Here's case in point, Exhibit A. There is a scene where Clint Eastwood's character, and in a moment we'll talk about the storyline and what the character's up to, but the character, you know, bear in mind, a man who's well up in age, punches out, sucker punches, a much younger man who's not only younger by decades, but looks really fit, like it could be in a boxing ring. And the guy goes down. Admittedly, the guy wasn't expecting the punch, but still the guy goes down and stays down, right? Because you don't get up again when it's Clint Eastwood who punches you out. And there are other scenes like that that are really kind of almost creaky. And again, without spoiling aspects of the plot that we'll be discussing in more detail, at the moment, I'll mention there are a few scenes where Clint Eastwood is dancing. And in fact, it's with his new romantic partner. And wouldn't you know it, she's really beautiful and she's really decades younger than he is. And I think, wish fulfillment that, you know, you can be 91 years old, you know, as an actor and you still get the girl. And what a catch, you know, she's how many decades younger. But the point I'm making at the moment is as they're dancing, the camera work, as in that punch out scene, the camera work is really kind of awkward and also very careful with the framing in that he's, you know, slow of gait. I mean, he's not moving the way he once moved. And the camera's trying to take that into account. And so it is awkward with the punch out scene. It's also, frankly, kind of awkward with two or three of the dance scenes because the camera's trying so carefully to show him dancing with this younger woman. But the framing of it and the duration of the shots and all that make it clear that these weren't very long takes. It's like, okay, have him take a few steps on the dance floor, cut to a different angle. You can almost sense them like guarding him, you know, not having like a full on, you know, lengthy take of him dancing because honestly, and you know, this is where it's kind of sad to contemplate, you know, he's doing what he can at this point and God bless him for that, right? But by the same token, as a viewer, you keep thinking it's a really careful frame for this particular scene. Because, you know, he's not quick of foot anymore. And yet on a dance floor, you want to have, you know, some mobility that way. So well, let me hand it back to you at this point, Mary, because I think we should get established what the storyline is. And it's essentially a character study, but still there is a framework of a story here.
Well, the basic framework is that Clint Eastwood plays a man who goes to Mexico to rescue a friend's son from a bad home situation. And it almost doesn't matter what the premise is because the whole point of the movie is, does Clint Eastwood get to be Clint Eastwood? And I thought that those moments were the high points of the movie. The scene you describe where he punches out the younger man is one of them because the reason I thought it worked is because, you know, whatever you do, don't underestimate Clint Eastwood. I mean, that's, you know, something that all comes up in every one of his movies. Those who do end up flattened on the ground, much to their amazement. So that's more for the audience who wants, you know, they want to see Clint Eastwood punch somebody out. So they deliver that without dwelling too much upon it. I agree with you, the way they block it and shoot it. It's almost certainly a stuntman who throws that punch. But it's believable because it's Clint Eastwood. They also give Clint Eastwood a chance to give you that old beat up, battered cowboy. There's a really funny scene where he's behind a car full of young women all headed to the beaches in Mexico. And the border guard is just absolutely charmed to let in these young women in their bikinis to go to the beach and flirts with them. And then once they're on their way, you know, Clint Eastwood rolls up and he has none of the same attitude towards this older man who, you know, what are you doing here? Why are you coming into Mexico? And then the next thing you see is, you know, Clint Eastwood has, you know, stopped the car to get out and sleep outside. You know, there's a little fire. So, you know, even at 91, you know, you can still imagine Clint Eastwood would be able to rough it like that, to just sleep outside with a blanket. Not everybody can kind of pull that off as an expected thing that you're going to do in your character, but it gives it that rugged Clint Eastwood feel, don't you think?
Well, you know, Marie, I agree, but it's a qualified agreement. You're absolutely right. He's such an iconic movie star that in a story like this one, the story almost doesn't matter at certain points. It has its twists and turns, but some of them are oh so convenient, or punching out the guy like that, where I keep saying borderline implausible. And, you know, the dance number's kind of creaky and so on, but it's essentially just spending time with Clint Eastwood. But this is where my agreement is partial. As much as I admire him as an iconic figure in American film history and his stature as a director as well, and late in his career making some of his better films. I don't think this is one of his better films, but still making some strong films into his 80s and now 90s. But where I'm disagreeing somewhat, or at least a qualified yes, is that can only take you so far. In other words, this film is a very, very slow ride. You know, he's going into Mexico to rescue a kid. A lot of the scenes just barely amount to scenes. It's scenery, which is very attractive. It's great desert scenery, but it's Clint Eastwood in a car, you know, and a close-up of that grizzled face. And yes, I agree with you. That's enough sometimes just to see that face. But then when the next scene, the one after that, is essentially a variation on the same thing, it kind of slows down to the point where you think, you know, is it going to grind to a halt? It never does entirely, but it definitely is an issue in terms of, you know, this figure who, I want to see that face, but you know what it reminded me of? And let me get your take on this, Marie, in terms of recent Clint Eastwood movies. Think about Clint Eastwood's The Mule, in which he's another elderly guy who spends a lot of time in his car. You don't have to walk when you're in a car, right? He's a lot of time in his car. And in that case, he's an elderly man who decides to become a drug mule, you know, and all the situations he gets into. But both movies have in common the fact that I would be guessing the percentage, but a high percentage of scenes are just simply Clint Eastwood behind the wheel of the car going through desert landscape. And you know what? At feature length, much as I admire the guy, and I keep saying that, much as I admire the guy, it starts to wear a bit. And I think, you know, this is getting kind of thin as material goes.
I agree with you that I could not help but think about The Mule when I was watching it and trying to decide which was the better movie. And in terms of where I would want to leave it if this was my career. One thing, when I went into this movie, you know, what I had read about it said that, you know, it's a coming of age story for the young man that he's rescuing. But it's also this idea of Clint Eastwood as a male role model. You know, I think the tagline for the movie said something about how he teaches this young man, you know, how to be a good man. And did you think that the movie delivered on that?
Marie, I didn't entirely think it followed through. And we should spell out the story a bit more. Clint Eastwood's character had been a rodeo rider in his youth, had a serious injury, never was able to return to that as a career. And then from having been a rodeo rider and one who was quite famous, according to, you know, what we learn of his early background, from there became a horse trainer. And doing that for decades. And his boss, or former boss, played by Dwight Yoakam, is asking him to go to Mexico to rescue 13-year-old son. The Dwight Yoakam character had an acrimonious split with the mother. There's all kinds of bad feeling there. There's also some financial consideration. The film does spell that out. What I didn't find convincing was several fold. The reasons that Eastwood would accept the assignment, I guess so. But then as he gets into it, that he would keep going on this thing, I guess so. And then the boy's mother is such an over the top, just wild woman, if you will, that it was almost cartoonish at times, mm-hmm. the way she was presented as a femme fatale on overdrive or something. And the movie kind of veers into like a really sort of strange, you know, almost like a spaghetti Western type over the top storyline, which is not the way the rest of the film really plays, but those scenes do. Next, by way of, and so much that it's borderline implausible, the way the boy behaves in terms of being a rebel and running away, but then bonding with Eastwood's character. I know they're meant to bond, and I know Eastwood's meant to be a kind of mentor to him, and it works relatively well, but there are a lot of scenes where it just seemed forced. It just didn't seem like it was happening naturally for me. Where it did work for me, as we spend time in the car, and we spend a lot of time there, as we spend that time in the car, you really just start to empathize with this aging character trying late in life to become a father figure to someone. And some of that is actually quite moving to watch just because it's Clint Eastwood showing a gentler side. And one of my favorite moments in the film, a stretch of dialogue, think of all the macho traits that we associate with Clint Eastwood. And now, late in this character's life and late in the director slash actor's life, reflecting back on that, trying to give advice and so on. And there's a scene where his character, whose name is Mike Milo, there's a scene where Mike says, quote, "This macho thing is overrated. You think you have all the answers, but then you get older and realize you don't have any. By the time you figure it out, it's too late." And that was such a good line of dialogue because so much of what works in the movie has to do with the fact that this crusty old character does have some goodness in him and it needs to be brought out again. And yes, sure enough, it'll be this teenage kid who brings that out because Mike Milo, the character, will have his own life on the line oftentimes. There are all sorts of bad guys, you know, chasing him down the highway and so on, and people you need to punch out on occasion. And as he does that, you know, that really, really reinforces thematically what works in the film. And even though I thought it was much too slow and sometimes just, you know, just kept veering in directions that were like plot contrivances. Like sometimes like you're on the road and at just the exact right dramatic moment, the bad guys show up in the car. I mean, the timing on this, like it's a lonely stretch of highway, but you know, the timing was impeccable that suddenly the bad guys are on your tail, they're chasing you. And that'll happen for convenience sake in any movie, I suppose. But here, Marie, it seems like every few scenes, there'll be a variation on that. And then likewise, at the point where you want to have him open up and become warmer and gentler and so on, he and the boy come into a cantina and it's the woman they meet that you know, will become a love interest. And again, when the two of them are dancing together, you've got Clint Eastwood in his 90s, this beautiful young to middle-aged woman dancing with him. They're falling in love with each other. I think, well, yeah, that could happen in life, but maybe only in Clint Eastwood's life.
Now, I want to make sure we mention the fact that there is a rooster that the young man has been using for cockfighting when we first meet him, and that this rooster is named Macho. And I just want to throw it out there to you that the title, Cry Macho, didn't know what to think, what that meant going in. Having the rooster named Macho, I didn't know if that was supposed to lead to several double entendres with the idea of, you know, Cry Macho, like tell us it's the dawn. Or if it was really underlining some of the discussions that Clint Eastwood's having with this young man, where he's basically saying, you know, being macho is really not all it's cracked up to be. And some of those conversations in the car are great. I like the one where he's talking about his career as a rodeo guy and how, you know, and then you get thrown off the horse and you're injured. Like, what an idiot. What kind of idiot would do that kind of job? Of course, he's talking about himself, very, you know, self-deprecating, which you don't see coming, which does feel like a really nice moment. But in terms of the bird and the title, Mike, what do you want to say about that?
Well, Marie, that was actually why I used that quotation from his character about this whole macho thing being overrated, because the kid looking for role models is thinking about macho imagery, has this rooster that's used in fighting. And, you know, because the bird's name is Macho, there are a lot of jokes and a lot of lines of dialogue that play off of that. There is some innuendo there. There's also just the whole macho ethos. That's why then Clint Eastwood in that quotation, I guess, says, you know, the whole macho thing is overrated. It works within the film. Frankly, it is heavy-handed. I mean, there are places where it's like, you know, like you could almost like look at the page of the script and where somebody underlined that, like, you know, a significant line of dialogue or a reference to the bird. So that, you know, even though it's thematically appropriate, it kind of rankled me a bit because it was just like so obvious and so underscored. And also the fact that the bird itself not only fights other roosters, these street fights there with the roosters, and of course naming the bird Macho. Yeah, I get the point, a little heavy, but I get the point. But also that the bird also in a scene, without spoiling exactly what's involved, takes on a human being and attacks a person. And I thought, this really is a very gifted fighting bird. Not only can it go after a person, but just the right bad guy to go after. And in its own way, just as Clint Eastwood punching out this other guy seemed kind of implausible, the fact that the bird was so highly skilled and highly selective as to who it attacked and so on, that's where you just have to go with the flow of it at that point, because it's so easy to pick apart at the level of plausibility.
I think this is, we keep referring to this indirectly, but I think that is the weakness of the film, is the moments where it does veer off into cartoonishness. Like you mentioned, the young boy's mother is sort of a cartoonish character. The way the bird is, almost sentient in a human way to know when to participate in what's going on and when to, not be a very well-trained bird. But I did want to mention, I thought the cinematography was gorgeous. And of course, Clint Eastwood, when all else fails, lets the hat do some acting. He'll tilt his head, so you're just getting the top of the hat. Excellent use of hats in a movie, I will say. Do you think it has a chance of getting any nods for the cinematography when it comes time for the Oscars?
Marie, you're making a very good point here, because so much of it is just framing that iconic Clint Eastwood image. There are scenes where he is out in the desert, and it's maybe dusk, let's say, and he's sitting in, and you get him in profile, I'm silhouetted, and it's the hat that is carrying the performance at that point. Those are like our picture postcard views of what we think of when we think about Clint Eastwood. I don't think the film is, frankly, really deserving of Academy Award nominations, but if it were to get any, if Clint Eastwood himself got any, it would just be a sentimental vote, if you will. It's not one of his stronger films. But if it were to get in technical categories, certainly cinematography, because it's a well-shot film. And the thing about Clint Eastwood is he has a very unadorned, straightforward style, but occasionally he'll set up a shot that really is quite striking. And the film does have some of those, but ironically, it's also where the film sometimes sort of grinds to a halt. Like they're driving along and then he gets out and sits in the desert and they'll hold the shot. And I'm thinking, this film already is a very slow ride. When the car stops and it's just framing Clint Eastwood, okay, I can appreciate that, but at some point, man, you got to get back in the car and move on to the next stop. And the film is so leisurely. It really takes its time there. And I think, frankly, just takes too much time. It's just really, as much as we've said there are things to admire here, it's really kind of a long, long drive from Mexico back to the States.
Now, one of the nicer moments, I think, in the movie is the romance between him and the woman who runs the cantina. That idea of, second chances, even late in life when you aren't even looking. But it does sort of fly in the face of that classic Western cowboy rolls into town, saves the day, and then, heads off into the sunset alone, And the movie that this reminded me of that I think was done better was Robert Duvall in Tender Mercies.
Yeah, I actually use Tender Mercies in a course I teach. I do courses on Hollywood through the decades, and Tender Mercies is a really strong film. And again, it has a deliberate pace and it's a really strong character study. But you're right about the cowboy who's been essentially a loner, or if he had connections, they're all broken at this point, but having a second chance, meeting a younger person. And that actually does tug at the heartstrings. So, there are moments where, as he meets the younger woman who runs the cantina, yes, emotionally that'll work for me. Even if intellectually, logically, I'm thinking, well, I don't know, would this be likely, whatever. But once it actually plays out, sure, I can go with it at that point. And I really feel that those are some of the more genuinely sentimental scenes in the film that work. And again, there is that loner cowboy kind of riding off into the sunset, if you will. And now, maybe not on horseback, but in a car, Clint Eastwood has been doing, variations on that. So he knows his screen image and he can kid it a little bit. Like there's a scene that's actually kind of funny because even though this film is often overstated, there's a really understated scene I like a lot because they stop in a lot of little towns and there's always going to be trouble in one of these towns, right? And he and the kid pull into one of these towns and Clint Eastwood says something like, "This looks like an interesting town. Let's check it out." And that's where you can tell they're sort of kidding, the formula. They know what they're getting into there. And I actually laughed during that. I thought he's having some fun with this kind of, archetypal storyline of the cowboy riding into town. That is an interesting town. Let's check it out.
Now, one thing I wanted to mention, just so people understand that, even though we've kind of said that it's not his best performance. Yeah, I think he did put all of himself into it because he wrote one of the music themes that comes up multiple times in the film. It's called Time Lapse in the official soundtrack, and he also performs it. So clearly it was, even if it doesn't hit on all cylinders, I think it's an attempt to make a film that will be liked by many people. Which brings us to our second movie, which is The Eyes of Tammy Faye. And again, I was struck by, you know, I knew the story. I remember seeing the TV movie back in the day with Bernadette Peters in it as Tammy Faye Baker. And, you know, since that came out, she has had, of course, she's no longer with us, but she has had an upgrading of her image, I would say. You know, she appeared on talk shows after the scandal broke. And I don't know, I think kind of redeemed herself in a way as somebody who made mistakes and owned them, but also was just very relatable. And I think that's kind of where they start with this movie. Instead of starting with the scandal, they start by showing you the really, really early days of two sweet-natured people who kind of stumble into fame. And then it kind of takes some familiar trajectories where it's a rags to riches story, where you achieve the great heights and then you're, you know, cast down into the abyss. Where to start with The Eyes of Tammy Faye, Mike?
Well, let me start where you left off there, because one of the things that works in the film, but in a very predictable way, is this is a really, really predictable showbiz biopic kind of thing. In other words, it's a familiarity of, you know, you have these two people, humble origins, but it's, you know, it's the rise and then the fall and then the redemption. And Americans love redemption stories that way. You know, because somebody is making it, they're at the pinnacle, and then for various reasons, self-inflicted and otherwise, they take a big fall, but then they can redeem themselves and we can forgive them. We can like them or like them again. I've got to say, I never particularly liked her. I never really had strong feelings about her. She was a pop culture phenomenon that I was tracking, let's put it that way. So I never thought of her as somehow a villain. By the same token, I was never a member of the fan club. No, I'm getting at, I was just like kind of tracking her, finding her an interesting phenomenon. But Marie, to your original point, in terms of the evolution of our response to Tammy Faye Baker, I find this quite interesting. There was a documentary film in 2000 with the exact same title, The Eyes of Tammy Faye. I think I was like so amused, and I saw it back then when it came out. I wrote about it when it first came out. And I thought, my goodness, here, like, you know, 20 years later, you know, a fictional film, but it's using the exact same title as this documentary. Now, the point I'm making right now is that documentary from 2000 was narrated by none other than RuPaul. And that film has a very campy tone. I mean, she that one reason I was always interested in her as a pop culture phenomenon was it was just the camp value of it. All that makeup, all that quote unquote sincerity, whether it was sincere or not, but all that on the surface. And just simply, you know, that kind of, whether you liked her or didn't like her or were indifferent, you couldn't ignore her, right? She was there on the scene. What I find curious is, she died in 2007, and posthumously, I think people who might not have forgiven her in life are more inclined to afterwards. It's part of the redemption saga. So now in 2021, we get this feature film, and Jessica Chastain, who plays her, she has an image that people like, and they should, right? I mean, positive associations, right? And she's playing Tammy Faye. What's striking about the film, and I had very mixed feelings about this film and wasn't crazy about it, but what's curious to me is in this new film about Tammy Faye Baker, she is presented in a very sympathetic light. And even though her husband is the ostensible villain, even he has chances at redemption as the story heads into the home stretch. So the film is kind of soft and sentimental that way, considering the financial shenanigans that he was guilty of, but you always have to wonder to what extent was she privy to a lot of this. She certainly benefited from the malfeasance, to use that word, but you know, to what extent she was culpable, or she's almost like a mafia wife in that respect. He was cooking the books and doing all this illegal stuff. Meantime, when she's buying jewelry and big houses and this and that, at any point would she ever stop and wonder, well, where's this money coming from? Is it all from the collection basket? And if so, should so much of it go to us? The film treads gently and actually is not nearly as tough as it could be because she kind of gets off the hook here. What do you think? I mean, I think it lets her off easy and makes her likable, maybe more likable than she should be. I mean, that's sort of a risky thing to say, but what do you think? It seems like she's almost presented like as this victim. And I'm wondering to what extent she was also culpable or certainly made the most of their time living the high life. They made a lot of money off their ministry.
I think that it pulls its punches a couple of times. It glances off of the Jessica Hahn business without really going into that. It has her, the man she actually ends up marrying, her second husband, in there as a, you know, someone who's interested in her, but they at no time in the movie ever tell you that she then went on to have a second marriage with that guy. But I do think in some ways, yes, it does. It definitely does burnish her image as if she had no culpability in anything that went on. But, you know, when I think about where she was after the scandal, I keep coming back to this one appearance she made on, I think it was Oprah. And what I think the reason people found her so likable was she was in real life just so earthy, because she grabs, you know, the part of her back. She's like, what is this back fat? Why do I have this? Why is this on my body? And of course, everybody in, you know, Oprah's studio laughed because it was such a real moment. And also, you know, people could relate to that and no one ever says it. I think Jessica Chastain is absolutely amazing in this. All of the 80s stuff that you see, the hair, the shoulder pads, all of it is so incredibly well done. I think I saw a couple of outfits and hairdos that I once had. I think the one thing I came away from, and I want to see if you think the same, is it was really too bad that Tammy Faye never made a John Waters movie.
Well, we'll have to ask John about that. But in terms of Jessica Chastain, I didn't care for the performance quite as much. In fact, the New York Times review, you know, really took Andrew Garfield, who plays Jim Baker, to task for mugging and emoting with sketch comedy abandon. I'm paraphrasing the review here. And then in terms of Jessica Chastain, it says, quote, she is trapped by a literal-minded script and overwhelmed by hair, makeup, and garish period costumes. The Bakers were many things to many people, appalling, inspiring, laughable, sad. This movie succeeds in making them dull. And I really felt that the movie was superficial that way. It really just plays off of that image, and it doesn't really go very deep in terms of what they actually were involved in with other people, with the ministry and so on. It's there, but it doesn't push very hard on it. I think it lets them off easy, and certainly in her case, presents her as a nearly heroic figure because of the earthiness, because of the genuine quality, the sincerity. And I'm not sure, Funky, I buy all that. I mean, I enjoyed the film, but I'm not sure I was really convinced by its depiction of her.
I think in the end, the choice to do it that way was a choice to make it likable, to make people likable. And in that respect, it was probably a good decision. But that brings us to the end of this episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.